Welcome to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Rizza. I'm an allied healthcare professional that has worked in the industry for over 25 years, with the majority of my practice being in the private physical therapy space and in public school athletics. My curiosity prompted me to create Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast to discuss the ever-changing landscape in the healthcare industry, focusing on sports medicine, physical therapy, athletic training, and sports science. Each week, we will discuss the barriers that healthcare professionals face and how we as individuals can collaborate to make the listener better understand the industry for a better patient and athlete experience. Now, on to the show. On this week's Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast, we welcome Dr. Thomas Gill. Dr. Gill is professor of orthopedic surgery at Tufts University School of Medicine, chairman of orthopedic surgery for the Steward Healthcare System, co-director of the New England Baptist Sports Medicine Fellowship Program, and director of the Boston Sports Medicine and Research Institute. Dr. Gill has a strong commitment to education and serves as course director or faculty member for many continuing medical education courses. After graduating Phi Beta Kappa and magna cum laude in biology from Harvard College, Dr. Gill received his medical degree from Harvard Medical School. He performed his internship in general surgery at the Massachusetts General Hospital and completed his orthopedic surgery training at the Harvard Combined Orthopedic Residency Program. Upon his graduation, Dr. Gill was awarded the Maurice E. Mueller Scholarship to study adult reconstructive surgery in Bern, Switzerland, and throughout other European academic centers. He then completed his fellowship training in sports medicine and shoulder surgery at the Stedman Hawkins Clinic in Vail, Colorado. Dr. Gill has served as medical director for the Boston Red Sox, head team physician for the New England Patriots, team physician for the Boston Bruins, and medical director of the Boston Ballet. He is a fellow of the American Association of Orthopedic Surgeons, a member of the American Orthopedic Society for Sports Medicine, has been a member of the team physician societies of Major League Baseball, the National Football League, and the National Hockey League, and was elected to the Herodica Society and the American Orthopedic Association. Dr. Gill's primary clinical and research interests include knee and shoulder injuries, and he has a particular interest in biomechanics of the knee and shoulder, as well as tissue engineering techniques for the joint preservation and cartilage repair in the knee. Dr. Gill has authored over 200 original articles and chapters on basic science and clinical issues involving the knee and the shoulder, and has previously written books on complications of shoulder surgery and techniques of knee arthroscopy. Now, on to the show. All right. Dr. Gill, welcome to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast.
Hey, Andrew. Great to be here with you.
It's been a long time. We've, I think, been together for, this is 20, coming up on 26 years, I think. So we've seen each other's kids grow up from the football field in Weston to now everybody out of college and hopefully off the payroll.
It's really hard to believe, but that last comment's never going to happen. So
I know we just, you know, our daughter's in DC right now. We had to go down last weekend and find her a new apartment. And of course she's in graduate school for two more years after this year. So I guess at least two more years on the payroll. So if you need a place in DC, I have an extra one.
I will definitely come down and check that out.
So again, welcome. I think, you know, one of the things we want to go over today, I think, is your experience as an orthopedic surgeon, where you see the healthcare landscape transitioning and some of the things that you've accomplished over your career, and maybe some of the better times and the not so better times, or good times, I should say, within, you know, athletics and maybe your practice. So why did you want to become an orthopedic surgeon, or I should say a physician, and what made you specialize in orthopedics?
Yeah, you know, I try to keep track of that, especially these days when the practice of medicine seems to be changing externally so much with regulations and government guidelines and everything. And I encourage my students, my residents, my fellows, out of the junior staff, so never forget that question you just asked. Why did you go into medicine to start with? Because if you lose track of that, I think you really lose an opportunity to really get the maximum amount of enjoyment out of the career. You know, for me, it was like a lot of people early on. My father was a physician. He was a researcher in immunology, genetics, and pathology, which, as an aside, were the only three classes that I almost failed during my entire academic career, or the three that my father's a professor of. So I guess genetics didn't exactly work in our family, but still. But I got exposed from a very early age to medicine. You know, I'd go in with him on Saturday mornings just to be able to, you know, he was gone a lot. So anytime I had to spend time with him was, you know, I treasured. And so when as a kid, I'd go with him to the hospital to grand rounds and listen to these luminary surgeons, physicians, researchers give talks on what they were trying to do to help people, new cutting edge transplantation talks and genetics and different types of cardiology interventions. So I kind of said, you know, this is pretty cool. And this is, you know, something I want to do. And in college, you know, I thought that, well, I thought medicine was going to be my track for a while. All my friends were heading off to Wall Street and doing business. So for a little while, I thought, you know, can I come at medicine from the opposite side? Can I come from the business side and try to, you know, redo the healthcare system and, you know, invest in biotechnologies to help people? But, you know, at the end of the day, I've always asked myself, or I said at that time, when I'm the age I am now, which is hard to believe where we are now, but I said, I don't want to have any regrets. And I knew that going into medicine, I was never going to have any regrets when I got older. And I couldn't necessarily say that with some of the other fields I was looking at. And it turned out to be true. It was, I have no regrets about anything. And I feel like I've been blessed to be able to have the type of job that I've had.
Well, that's great. I mean, I have to say, I'm glad you became an orthopedic surgeon because we never would have met. And I think I consider you a mentor to me because I look back at the times we've stood countless times on the sidelines covering football games and being able to ask you questions and having that direct, you know, one-on-one relationship with you kind of candidly on the sideline with no interruptions. So, again, you've opened up a lot of doors for me and being able to meet, you know, residents and fellows that have worked with you that have opened those relationships for me, which has been fantastic. So I think it pays off in dividends to be able to, you know, someone that gets into a profession, but then use the mentorship and have that relationship with that person. So I think it's important. I thank you for that. It's been a great, you know, 26 years, and hopefully there's not 26 more, but a few more.
Well, I'll tell you, the feeling's mutual though, Andrea. And I think that one of the great things about orthopedics in general and sports medicine in particular, and you know, from, you know, my days working at MGH and putting together the sports medicine service there to being now with Newland Baptist and, you know, the other centers that we have, it's sports medicine is all about building a team, and you've just been a phenomenal partner over those 26 years. I can honestly say, and people, you know, with a lot of in sports medicine in particular, we deal with a lot of athletes with concussions, for instance, and a lot of soft tissue injuries. And anytime someone says, you know, I get calls from across the country, who should I have evaluate this kid with a concussion in your area? Like, who's the best concussion specialist around? I always say the same thing. It's Andrew Rizza. It's not professor down at this hospital. That has Andrew is hands down the most knowledgeable, caring, best practitioner when it comes to things like concussions, but not just concussions, but the young athlete. I really think you have no peers, and it's really been a pleasure working with you.
Oh, I appreciate that. Hopefully I don't get a million calls for concussion, but I'll take
it. Oh, not just concussions. Yeah, as you know, I sent my own daughter when she had her ACL. Guess who did her rehab? You.
Yeah, so I did. And she was fantastic. While you were at Harvard or even in residency, were you ever unsure of your path? Did you ever take a second guess and say, you know, maybe not orthopedics. Maybe I want to go into gen med. Maybe I want to go into cardiopulm. Was there anything that ever swayed you while you were going through your medical school experience?
Absolutely. And what I tell a lot of our students now is, I won't call it a crisis of faith because it's not a crisis of faith. It's more staying open-minded. If you don't question, you know, what field you're going to go into, I think you have to ask yourself, am I really going at this the right way? Do I really have an open mind? Do I really just love the entire field of medicine? Because I remember when I was a second year in medical school, even though I thought I was going to be an orthopedic surgeon, you know, I would take cardiology, pathophysiology, or, you know, pulmonary, or GI, or whatever the different types of pathophysiology courses. And I'm like, that's what I'm going to go into. Oh, this is so cool. This is amazing what I learned today about how, you know, what goes wrong with the heart, what goes wrong with the intestine, what goes wrong with the nervous system. And I think if you go through the fact that you're quote unquote questioning simply means you're excited about the field, you're excited about medicine, and no matter what you go into, I think you're going to be happier. So, Yeah, for me, it came down to two things. I had a phenomenal professor that was teaching me cardiology and cardiovascular pathophysiology. And I knew I wanted to do something, you know, in athletics and sports and those types of injuries. But also I was thinking cardiology, you know, the effect of training on the heart, the effect of training on the lungs, you know, how can we optimize that? And so I thought for a while about cardiology, but then at the end of the day, I said, you know, I'd really love to be able to come into someone's life and make as big a difference as possible in a very short period of time, really help them kind of turn their life around when it's been a little bit, you know, turned upside down. And I couldn't think of a better way to do that than with orthopedic surgery.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point because we talk a lot about how do we influence people's lives. I think medicine in general, everybody is influenced through medicine. But I think we have a quicker path to that with orthopedic surgery, physical therapy, athletic training, where we're the first responders on the field as an athletic trainer. You are the next respondent to be able to evaluate, treat, maybe refer if they don't need surgery. But if they do need surgery, you're the one, you know, providing the procedure. And it's life-changing for a lot of these people where they may be reliant on us. You could go back to their job or go back to the family to help their family. But more importantly, there's a lot of kids that rely on athletics to get out of the situation they're in and the community they're in. You know, us being in the Wellesley, Weston area, there's not a lot of kids that rely on sports to get out to go to college. So they're pretty fortunate. But you look around the country, and I'm sure that's not the case for everybody. So I think there's definitely a big influence on what we can provide. So I think that, and you've definitely had that influence on a lot of people, especially the amount of people you've seen over the years.
Well, I'll say the other thing that's been great, and I've seen this happen every time I come into your training room, it's not quite the bar scene and cheers, you know, with, you know, Norman, everyone coming in, but it's where everybody calls home. It's you've built a, to use the terminology of today, a safe place, you know, for these kids where they're stressed out about school, they're stressed out about college, maybe they're stressed out about some things at home, but you know, they come to us and they especially come to you, and you know, it's, you're an authority figure, an adult figure that they can talk to, whether it's about sports, whether it's about health, or whether it's about life in general, you know, careers. And that's one of the things that I've really enjoyed about, you know, working with you and working at Weston is being able to stay rooted in high school, which I always say is the true sports medicine, right? That's really when you're talking about taking care of the whole student athlete, not just what goes on the field, but a lot of times what goes off the field, and help guide them, you know, to potentially maybe some career paths in the future. So that's really one of the special things about this for me. And I know it is for you as well.
Yeah. I mean, it's nice to see when kids come back or they call you when they're in college, when they have an injury and they don't have the relationship with their athletic trainer at college or somebody who else they're, you know, relying on, and they call you. It makes you feel good to understand that, hey, you actually made a difference in that person's life. And we've had several Weston grads over the years that have gone on to medical school. And one of them, as we know very well, Dr. Roth is now an orthopedic down in Arizona.
That is so frightening to believe, but yeah, he's phenomenal, but it just means I'm getting that old. I can remember when he was in your training room.
Yeah.
And now he's a great surgeon in Arizona. So
yeah. Amen. Yeah. I'm going to see him next week when I'm in Arizona. We're going to get together and have some lunch. So nice. Maybe we'll FaceTime you while we're having
lunch. Please do.
So with that being said, I think that the biggest challenge for us is trying to understand where healthcare is going. I think in the public space, how are people enduring the cost? What are you seeing on the orthopedic side? Do you ever have, you know, patients come in and say, you know what, I can't afford that injection because of the copay, or I can't afford to have surgery. Does that ever come up in conversation with the people you're dealing with? And if so, how do you end up dealing with it?
So, you know, I think there's been a real evolution. There's multiple questions and there's multiple issues in kind of the topic you just brought up. But just to start for a minute on the cost side of things, you know, if you look at what's going on in the United States right now and you compare it to, say, Canada, because a lot of people say, oh, we should have a system like Canada. You know, they do such this great job. They don't, quote unquote, they don't pay anything for their health care. And we need to be more like Canada. So, well, let's take a step back for a minute. You know, in Canada, you know, your taxes can be up to over 50% of your income. So you're not getting something for nothing. Okay. It's not free. It's, you know, I get free breakfast with this hotel room. Well, the hotel room is another $100 than it needed to be because they were throwing breakfast in. So, you know, there's a reason that you're not paying extra for healthcare. But if you look at these nationalized healthcare systems that quote unquote keep costs down, they do a great job at population health. But, you know, having lived through this with a family member, they don't do the best job at taking care of the individual. So what do I mean by that? So in the United States, and our, to be frank, you know, our costs are a little bit out of control. Something like over 50%, 60% of our healthcare money at least is spent in the last year of life, mm-hmm. because we're spending time sending, you know, 94-year-old, 95-year-olds to the ICU that have no chance of getting out. But, you know, we invest because, you know, that's somebody's grandmother, that's somebody's family member. And I think we've made a decision as a society that was, you know, something that's, that we value. You know, whether we're going to be able to continue to do that, I don't know. I don't know if the medicine or the money's going to be there. But if it's like, if it's you, if it's your family member who maybe has a cancer that's incredibly rare, doesn't have a great chance of being cured, but we still want to be able to try, right? We still want to, we feel like we can, because every once in a while we come through. You know, in Canada, from my own personal experiences, they look at, well, if we can take care of this 90% and with invest in preventive care, invest in staying healthy, understanding there's 10% of people that have a bad cancer or a bad cardiac issue, maybe they're going to take way too much funding. So I don't know that we're going to sign off on letting those patients get the experimental therapies, get kind of the cutting edge therapy that's going to be much more expensive. And a lot of those patients end up coming to the United States to try to have that happen. But they've made mm-hmm. that decision as a society. That's the way they're going to do. You know, yeah. I have friends that are orthopedic surgeons there that their offices have to shut down for 3 weeks because the country's already met its budget. So they cancel all elective surgery.
That's interesting.
In the United States, is that something that we want to do? I don't know. I personally, my answer is I don't want to do it that way. But I, the flip side is I don't know of many people the way, certainly in Massachusetts, but in the country, there's not a lot of people that aren't getting basic care. Mm-hmm. We do a pretty good job, I think, as a society of probably at the two extremes. You know, we ensure basic fundamental health care, whether or not you can pay for it. And if you can't afford to pay for it, we've got the best of the best up top. I think if we have to look as a society, where can we do better? It's in the middle. It's that mm-hmm. family, that person that doesn't make enough to be able to pay out of pocket for some of the newer biologic therapies, for instance, yeah. or they make more than they need to just for the fundamental care. So I think that's something we're really going to have to look at moving forward.
Yeah. You mentioned just their biologics. Now, that it's a question that everybody asks us in PT or even athletic training setting. What about biologics? Is that going to help me? What should I do? Should I? I've had an injection. I've had an arthroscopic procedure on my knee to clean out my knee. I still have knee pain. Is that something I should do? Should I go and have, should I get Synvisc? Should I get, other types of biologics or stem cell? Now, that in the most case, it's out of pocket. I've heard some situations where if it's in the OR, and I could be wrong about this, but I thought if it's in the OR being done in the OR, some of that gets covered at some level. But I know that for the majority of it, it doesn't get covered. It's out of pocket. Have you had conversations with other surgeons or even with the medical societies about trying to, if it is a procedure that's going to be beneficial for the patient, to cut down on insurance costs down the road for other procedures? Do you feel like that's going to come down to the point of being reimbursable through insurance or not?
Yeah. So I just wrote an article that was published in Clinical Orthopedics and Related Research on this exact topic. And, you know, one of was the actual topic was about price disparities around town. I showed around Boston for, you know, platelet rich plasma or PRP injections, which you and I have used in a lot of our athletes for muscle injuries, tendon injuries. We use it more for some arthritis, you know, the concept being, you know, you're using the body's own regenerative capabilities to try to treat itself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's the safest of all treatments, right? Because you're using you to treat you. So the chances of an adverse side effect is next to zero, nothing zero, because theoretically, anytime you puncture the skin, you can get an infection or something. But basically, as a medication or as a therapy goes, it's about as safe as you can get.
Yeah.
And the question comes up, if something has close to a zero risk profile and has the ability, or at least has been shown anecdotally, if not exactly with rigorous evidence-based medicine, but there's more and more evidence-based medicine coming out that says it can help. What is the ethical position of being able to provide these biologics for people? And what about saying that, you know, it's going to be only be used in patients who can afford to pay for it? What about people who can't necessarily, you know, afford to pay for it? Mm-hmm. From a And I think that's an ethical question that we need to think more about. I think from an insurance standpoint, insurance companies have made it very clear they're not going to pay for this. They used to pay more for the viscose supplementation, the Synvit and the Orthovit, and they've dialed way back on that. And a lot of the companies now don't pay for that either. I think that if you look at the usage and talk to people, like talk to the athletic trainers, talk to the orthopedic surgeons, talk to the sports medicine non-operative docs who treat patients with a lot of these biologic regenerative therapies, it's pretty clear that there's, at least in a significant portion, there's a lot of positive results. Mm-hmm. And I think that's going to be an area of great research. I think it's going to be an area that we need to try to standardize a little bit better. Like for PRP, do we use leukocyte rich or leukocyte poor? What is the right concentration of platelets that we want? What is the right timing after injury to give it? Should we have repeated treatments? Is it one enough? Do you need two? Do you need three? Should you have maintenance doses? So we have a lot to think about, a lot to work on, but I personally think it's a pretty exciting field for us right now in the world of sports medicine.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how it continues to evolve. And more people are for it. And I feel like we're in a community where cost sometimes doesn't have there's not a reason for a patient to shy away from cost because of where we are in the community. A lot of people have the funds and the economic return to be able to do that. So they have, if I have someone that comes in with medial epicondylitis and we've done, 8 weeks of physical therapy and they haven't gotten better and we send them back to the doctor, they're most likely going to pay for that type [S2] Sure. [S1] Of regenerative therapy, which is good. So, but I can see down the road where you have somebody that's, in more of a rural setting, other part of the country that needs this to help to get them to be able to walk to the grocery store. You know, how do we provide that to them? That's, out of pocket expense. So where do you think healthcare in general with the cost of, elevated insurances is going? Do you feel like there's I know that I was talking to a peer of mine and a mentor, Carl Gustafson, about where physical therapy is going, right? So we talked about how the cost is being transferred more to the patient, where when he graduated PT school 35 years ago, the average copay was $5 to $10 for everybody that came to PT, and the rate of reimbursement was $100 for everybody. He said 35 years later, now today we're at $60 to $65 with some people for copays, and their reimbursement is $120. So are you seeing any of that transferable into the orthopedic space at all, where the patients are really shouldering more of that cost out of pocket to be able to see you as a specialist?
I mean, I remember probably 10 or 15 years ago, like you're saying, the copays were extraordinarily low, $25, $30 to go to see a specialist or even a primary care, whatever it is. Just the benefit from, working at a hospital, the one benefit you hope you can get is a good healthcare package, right? Mm-hmm. good healthcare benefit. Yeah. And it was, extremely low monthly payments, and the deductible was next to zero, if not zero.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, I took that for granted most of my life. Now you look at what, quote unquote, the best of the best academic medical centers in town offer their employees. And it's hard to think you're going to get a better healthcare plan than, being taken care of in the place where you work. You hope that would help keep costs down, but you've got, $5,000-$6,000 deductibles.
Yeah.
And you have monthly costs that are three times what they were 10 years ago, 15 years mm-hmm. ago. Mm-hmm. And there's I see in my own practice, we're pretty busy year round, but there's always a mad rush towards the end of the year before the calendar year turns over and before everybody's copay and out-of-pocket expenses starts again, that everyone wants to, in October, November, December, wants to get all those elective procedures and surgery done because, $6,000, $8,000 out-of-pocket, that's a lot of money. I don't care how much money you make. That's a lot of money. And if you have a family of four, family of five, whatever it is. So people are really, you see people start to ration a lot of their care for the non-critical, non-emergent stuff, earlier in the year. And then as they, all of a sudden they meet their deductibles, maybe they have a little bit less of a threshold for coming to see a caregiver, but it's a real issue.
Yeah. I mean, we see it in PT. We talk about this every year, the fourth quarter, make sure patients understand that their insurance is going to reset. And most of them do. And they want to finish care. If someone started care in November, but they had a procedure done that's going to take 12 weeks, they may want to hold back or pull back a little bit January 1. So we're trying to have that conversation with them. If we can dose their therapy correctly over the time that they need it, they'll be done with therapy and be finished. But a lot of people like to push it away when they start to see that January 1st come in, which is kind of sad because, but I do understand it on a financial basis, but it'd be better if we could carry over and not have to reset that if somebody's in the middle of, getting care. But again, the insurance companies are for the insurance companies, I think.
That's an age old adage and that holds true today.
Yeah. If you have a patient that comes to you, say needs an ACL reconstruction, getting recruited for lacrosse, soccer, football, they're a junior, or even a sophomore now, there are sophomores getting recruited, right? Or even younger and freshmen. I've seen this change tremendously over the years. And they say to you, how long before I can get back on the field? Like, what is your response to them? And I know what mine is, and we've talked about this. What would you say to that athlete?
It's very simple for me. I say, whenever Andrew says you're ready, you're good to go back. But if not everybody gets to have you taking care of their ACL reconstruction. Yeah, so yeah. I'll try to give you a little bit more scientific about it. I think there's two answers to that question. And I think we've made leaps and bounds on how to take care of ACL patients. It used to be back in the day, if you tore your ACL in the 1980s, you had an open ACL reconstruction. You got put in a cast for 8 weeks, 10 weeks. When you came out of the cast, your knee was stiff, your quad had shriveled up to nothing. And then you're somehow trying to claw your way back into being just a functional human being, let alone an athlete, right?
Right.
And that's really gone through. Then Don Shelbourne came along, who was the team doctor at Purdue and with Indianapolis Colts for many years, and taught us all about accelerated rehab. Accelerated mm-hmm. rehab. That was the buzzword. And it was don't operate on anyone before 6 weeks, get the swelling down, get the motion back. And then within 6 months, they could be back on the field. And for him, he actually let people get back at 4 months sometimes because he would harvest the patella tendon from the opposite knee and thought we can get back faster. So we went from way too long to all of a sudden, I think, way too short a rehab. Mm-hmm. And I think we've had some good studies now which have showed a couple of really key things. First and foremost, you got to look at the biology of the ligament healing, and then you got to look at the functional ability of your patient. So biologically, we know that if you plot the strength of a ligament when you first put it in at time zero, it's actually stronger than at 6 weeks when the ligament is actually at its weakest, which, by the way, is when we start taking off braces and start moving people forward, which has always been a little bit of a conundrum for me. But and then it starts turning around and getting stronger again. And it's really about 18 months or so before the ligament is as strong as it's going to get. So that's why I like to say use a sports brace for the first year after surgery, because I know that ligament isn't as strong as it's going to be yet.
Yeah.
That being said, from a biologic perspective, if you look at what's called the ligamentization of the graft, it starts at around 6 months to be something that's, we can start really pushing, pivoting, jumping, running, twisting, practicing, so to speak.
Yeah.
And then for a long time, it was a very cookie cutter answer. You can go back, have your ACL, you'll be back in 6 months. But a lot of people just, think that if you have it done in January, then come July 1, you're ready to go. Mm-hmm. But you have people that have been working out every day during that period of time, and you have people that go to therapy once a week, and now they want to get back on the field. And they couldn't be two more different points of readiness. So I think what we found since then is strength measurements, jump tests, isokinetic tests, and then something that we've haven't talked nearly enough about. If you look at one of the best predictors of return to sport, it's psychologic. It's from the neck up, not the neck down. Mm-hmm. Fear of re-injury. It's confidence in their strength, confidence in their movement pattern. So the study that I tend to quote people now is like, we talk about all, when you return to sport has as much to do with you and how much time you invest in your rehab as it does in me or in your physical therapist or your rehab specialist. But the one study I like to say is if you look at the failures, the re-tears at 6 months, the risk of re-injury goes down by 50% for every month after 6 months until 9 months. Mm-hmm. Okay. So in other words, if it's a 8% risk at 6 months, it's a 4% risk at, I'm sorry, at 6 months, it's a 4% risk at 7 months. It's a 2% risk at 8 months. And then it showed that after 9 months, the wrist doesn't go down.
It so yeah.
If you have those twisting, pivoting, you know, cleats on turf type sports, as a rough guideline, I usually say 8-9 months is mm-hmm. what you should be shooting for.
Yeah.
But that's what you have to have from a surgeon. That's where it's so important to have a close relationship with your rehab professional, because it's not just a question of how long has it been from surgery. It's, you know, what can they do functionally?
So for the people that are listening and don't understand the why you have to wait 6 weeks to have a reconstructive surgery, can you explain a little bit about that and why?
So it used to be wait 6 weeks. And, you know, I did my fellowship out in Vail, Colorado at the Stedman Hawkins Clinic. And I left, you know, the Harvard residency program. And, you know, Boston is a pretty conservative place. You know, there's an old adage about medicine in Boston. There's a lot of great ideas that leave Boston, but not a lot that come in. You know, because we like to think if, you know, if we didn't invent it here, it doesn't exist. But, you know, when I was a resident, it was, you wouldn't think it was malpractice to operate on someone before 6 weeks. But if you kind of dialed it back and said, you know, why is that the case? It's because, you know, someone goes up to Killington skiing in the weekend up in Vermont, they tear their ACL, they come to the emergency room, they get given a knee immobilizer, say follow up with orthopedics in 3 or 4 weeks. By the time they see me, they haven't moved their knee in 3 weeks. The knee's big and swollen. They have quad atrophy. You know, they're not, they have quad inhibition. So you really needed 6, 7, 8 weeks just to get the functioning back. When I was in my fellowship, on the other hand, at the base of, you know, Vail Mountain, they were doing ACL surgery in 2 days, 3 days, 4 days after injury. And I was kind of like, well, you know, what's going on? This is against everything I learned. This just must be financially motivated, right? Because if the tourist goes home, then that clinic can't, you know, doesn't get to operate on the patient. But in fact, the difference was, as soon as someone comes off the mountain, you know, they've got that knee packed in ice to keep the swelling down and compression. They get the knee moving right away, so they never lose motion. You know, the old adage, if you never lose motion, you never have to regain motion.
Yeah.
They keep the quad. They've got, you know, stim going on the quad, so the quad never shuts down. So they keep the swelling down. They preserve motion. The quad never gets shut down. So in fact, that knee is ready. So what I tell my patients is, rather than a strict time frame now, it's when your knee is ready for surgery, that's mm-hmm. when we operate. And that can be as soon as 2 or 3 weeks. Maybe it's 6, 7, 8 weeks, depending on, you know, when they come to see us. But my criteria is you need at least about 125 degrees of motion, minimal swelling, good quad tone, and good protective function of the leg when they're walking. And when you can do those things, that's when they're ready for surgery.
Yeah, I think that's important because as athletic trainers, we see the athlete right away. And I mean, what I do is we start them right away. One, we get them in to you right away. Or if they're someone that has a relationship with another orthopedist that they want to see, we get them into them right away. So we kind of have the guideline where we draw like the skeletally immature to skeletally mature and draw that line of where we want to go with them and where they want to go. But I think it's important because we've had people that have seen you that are athletes that have done it before 6 weeks because we've done and followed the criteria. We've had some people that are in that come into rehab that know us that come in 2-3 days after an ACL tear. We start them on the prehab, get them ready. They see the surgeon if it's you or someone else, and then they're getting in a little bit faster too. So, I mean, that was a great point. We just have to understand that moving them sooner is better than not. And that goes with even post-op stuff that we see. And we see some post-op stuff that's, I mean, people don't want to move. They're afraid of it. The psychological component that you talked about, we really try to work hard with athletes getting them back on the field. And that's a big thing that we talk about all the time is one, it's not about your dynamic function. It's about your mental capacity because it's the ability for you to be able to get back on that field and not think that something's going to happen to you again, because that's the one thing that kids do. They shy away from going back and that's how they get hurt again. We talk about sleep. We talk about nutrition. We talk about hydration. We talk about the mental aspect, the mental rehab that we try to do with them. Keep them involved with their teams and their peers so they know that there's an end game, that they're involving themselves and they're having that camaraderie. They can still help and teach others in the sport while they're rehabbing. So we try to keep all that together. When we release them back to activity, you made a comment on cleats. I always tell athletes, get into turf shoes first. Let's get you 100%. In the turf shoes.
Absolutely.
Get used to working with turf shoes. Once you feel comfortable, you feel confident, let's get you back into some studs. Let's look at circular studs instead of triangular studs or square studs. So I think it's the knowledge base and feeding that to the athlete so they understand. And there are some where I say to them, listen, mark the calendar a year from today. If we make it in 9 months, it's a win. If you make it in 8 months, it's even a bigger win. But if it takes a year, you know what? It takes a year. We did it the way we needed to do it, and we didn't sacrifice anything. So I think it's trying to educate them the best we can.
It's also, I think if you tell your patient up front what to expect, it's all about setting expectations, right? You know, this is what you're going to do at 1 month, at 3 months, at 6 months. You should be back on the field roughly around this time. And then I tell everyone the same thing. You're going to be much better your second season back than your first season back. Bill Belichick used to talk about that all the time. Like, you know, you doctors always say, you know, it's 6 months and they're not ready. They're not worth, you know what, to me at 6 months, you know, yeah. Give them to me in a year and then we can talk. So, I was told Dr. Belichick, he actually had some great insights. He was a very smart guy on many fronts, to be sure. But it's true. So whether that's physical, I think a huge part of that's mental. I think that, you know, if we were really taking great care of our patients, and especially our young high school, college, part of seeing, you know, a physical therapist and athletic trainer, that we should also incorporate sports psychology, I think, at some point, because who's not spooked by, you know, the first time they ever get a significant injury.
Thank you for tuning in to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast. This is your host, Andrew Rizza. If you enjoyed the content from today's episode, give us a like, leave a comment, and share on social media. You can find us on Apple or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow us on Instagram at Behind Sports Med Podcast, on X under AJR Sports Sci, or check out our websites at ajrsportscience.podbean.com and at ajrsportscience.com. You can also subscribe to our YouTube channel at AJR Sports Science. Tune in for part 2 on May 27th, where Dr. Gill and I focus on the importance of mental aspects in sports medicine and the role of mentorship in shaping a successful career. We also go on to discuss and emphasize the importance of clear expectations and communication with young athletes to shape them as individuals and help them manage their injuries. We close out the episode by discussing the evolution of concussion management in sports and the role of neurocognitive testing. Dr. Gill then shares his experiences working with professional athletes and the different mentalities in football, hockey, and baseball.